Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life is produced by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, a division of the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences. Visit us online at whyradioshow.org.
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. On today's episode, we're talking with Jason D. Hill about his immigration from Jamaica to the United States and his philosophy of individualism. I'd like to talk about what counts as good evidence. This may seem a strange way to start an episode about immigration and the American dream, but almost all of our discussions about race, ethnicity, and class hang on what counts as support for our argument. On one side of the coin is the reliance on statistics. The percentage of crime is committed by people from this group, or that percent of that population ends up getting an education. On the other side are anecdotes, stories of hardship, success, and tragedy that capture our imagination and move us, sometimes even to care. The benefit of statistics is that they give us a bird's eye view of social patterns. The problem is that they don't tell us anything about particular cases. The benefit of anecdotes is that they promote empathy, but it is impossible to know whether they are representative of a one-off event. What's more, neither has implicit meaning. If we know that 50% of purple people eaters shoplift, we still don't know whether stores need more surveillance or the shoplifters just need bigger pockets. Just because Bruce was down on his luck through no fault of his own doesn't mean that anybody really cares at all. Evidence only makes sense if we establish, in advance, the narrative of which it is a part. Only context tells us our priorities, values, questions, preferences, and even goals. Only it explains the evidence. Consider the statistic that 29% of foreign-born Americans have a college degree. This may be interesting, but for most it won't strike much of a chord. But change the sentence to 29% of immigrants have a college degree, and we're much more likely to have an emotional reaction. The word immigrant is an American word. It is steeped in history, culture, and politics. It evokes Ellis Island and the American dream. It can also, to some, be scary, conjuring images of unwelcome job-stealing interlopers. But either interpretation only makes sense because the word immigrant is part of a larger narrative. America is a story, even more than it is a place. Today's episode is going to contrast two of those narratives. One is an America where groups are thought of collectively, a country where certain races or ethnicities are subject to expectations and limitations because they are first and foremost group members. Black Lives Matter tells the story, but so does the Daughters of the American Revolution. The other is an America where group membership is secondary to individual action, where blackness or family history are only embellishments on a particular person's specific behavior. Chambers of Commerce share this point of view. So does the ACLU. The group advocates insist that our institutions define in advance who is successful and who is not. The individualists retort that all circumstances can be overcome, although just because they can doesn't mean they will. The two are not mutually exclusive, of course. Group membership affects personal actions, and any one person can affect what groups can or can't do. But you have to pick one or the other to make sense of the facts we use to debate immigration. Does an immigrant go to college because she comes from China, where such things are expected? Or does Jiaying go to college because she is diligent, a forward-looking planner? What the statistics tell us depends on what we decide they will mean in advance. Today's guest is going to fall on the individualist side of the debate. He's going to argue that there is still an American dream, that it is universally applicable, and that too much emphasis has been placed on group membership. He's going to assert that identity politics has taken away individual responsibility and misrepresents the core American philosophy. Not surprisingly, he's going to make his argument while telling stories, his own immigrant history first and foremost, but also the stories of those who moved up the economic ladder with him. He is, and I hope he won't object me to saying so, a romantic, and his stories demand empathy. They are moving and empowering. But there are people who will object to his argument. They will say he isn't telling the statistical story, that for every success he recounts, there are numerous unnamed failures. The math, they will say, is the final word, not the people he just happened to know. I'll let him respond to that objection specifically. What I want to point out is that the statistic-based objection is just as much of a choice as his storytelling approach. Neither necessarily trumps the other. It is all about what you hope to accomplish. Today, we're immersing ourselves in the drama and grit of those who make new lives for themselves. We are accepting the fact that for some, America is indeed exceptional, a shining light on a hill. Our guest will try to convince us that we should all see it this way, but that's his job. Mine is to remind us that in this time of American cynicism and disillusionment, his approach is still very much worth attending to. And now our guest. This is Jason D. Hill's second visit to Why Radio. He's a professor of philosophy, members of the Honors Distinguished Faculty, and director of Teaching Practicum at DePaul University. He's the author of four books, the most recent of which is We Have Overcome, An Immigrant's Letter to the American People, which is available for pre-sale on Amazon.com, doing quite well, I might add. Jason, thanks for coming back to Why.
Thanks for having me, Jack. It's such a pleasure.
We're pre-recording the show, so we won't be stopping for comments, but please send us your thoughts at askwhyund.edu, post them on Twitter at Why Radio Show, or visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/whyradioshow. You can always join our live chat room at whyradioshow.org. So, Jason, am I right that today, June 10th, is your birthday?
That's right. It is. I turned 53.
Congratulations. I hope that this interview is a birthday gift, not a birthday nightmare.
It is a celebration indeed.
And congratulations on the new book. Its pre-sale is doing very well. You're getting a lot of attention. That must be really exciting, and that must be a wonderful gift as well.
It is.
I was thinking about where to start, because your book is so rich and has so many intriguing stories and challenges. But you describe very vividly a covenant, as you call it, a covenant that you made with America when it became your new home. And you decided that you would take responsibility for your own life and your own betterment. And I guess I was wondering, which came first, your commitment to individualism or your sense of connection to America as your new home?
Well, I think both in some sense. I mean, as a child growing up in Jamaica, I had always had a sort of spiritual rapport with America. America always represented this sort of celebratory ideal for me. It was the land of freedom, the land where you could enact a script for yourself and rewrite your entire humanity almost. I mean, one is given an identity that one didn't ask for, and with creative imagination, one can rewrite the self and make oneself into the human being that one aspires to be. So America always represented an aspirational identity for me, the person that I could become, the person I really wanted to become, not the identity that was bequeathed to me. And so in that sense, this romance with America started from way back when I was living as a child growing up in Jamaica. And then my individualism was something that I just found myself occupying or inhabiting really as a child growing up. I was always a rugged individualist, never identified with groups as such, and felt that I had certain sensibilities and certain qualities that were uniquely mine and that I identified with as uniquely mine. So I always felt as a rugged individualist as a child growing up, and the two wedded themselves quite beautifully.
Was your perspective about America, about individualism, was it a rarity in Jamaica, or was it more common? I know in America now, certain kinds of patriotism and certain senses of the American dream are really politically laden, and it can identify you as being associated with this group or that group, individualism as well. Was there that same tension in Jamaica, or is it less complex?
I think for most Jamaicans, America represented economic advancement. I don't think most Jamaicans were thinking as – I was quite a precocious child. I don't think most Jamaicans were thinking as philosophically as I was. I think most Jamaicans were thinking of America as a place of economic advancement, a place where one could achieve some sort of economic parity with their future compatriots or make something substantial or remarkable of their lives. And by default, one could do that by escaping from a kind of social or economic oppression, which many of them, those who were not from the middle class groups, or even those who were from the middle class groups, had suffered in their own native country.
Is there a strict, for lack of a better term, caste structure in Jamaica? Is there a tradition of upward mobility? I'm hoping I'm not being that guy by randomly picking something that I like, but I'm very involved. I love ska music, always have. And a lot of my visions of Jamaica come from the classic film, The Harder They Come, which is about upward mobility and entrepreneurship, but also crime. And there isn't in that vision this sense at all that there is a middle class, that there is an expectation that you move forward. That feels like a very American ideal, but I actually have no idea. So is there a rigor, is there a lot of room for upward mobility in Jamaica, or is it much more divided?
There isn't much room. There is a very rigid class system. So I came from a middle class background, and there is a very small class system. The majority of people in Jamaica are very, very poor, and you have a very small upper class, extremely wealthy class system, a small middle class, and a vast underclass of proletariats or peasants or working class people, most of whom are very, very poor and for whom there is very little chance for upward mobility. And it is also ruled by a system of pigmentocracy where your skin color. So there is no overt racism in terms of a one-drop rule. We have no formal system of a racial taxonomy in Jamaica. It's based on the color. The lighter your skin is, the more likely you are to be wealthy. And the skin color that's prized the most highly actually is brown skin. People who are extremely dark are more likely to be poor. And people who are brown or lighter in complexion are those who are more likely to be wealthy, and are treated in a much more fair and equitable manner. So there is a rigid system, and upward mobility is very difficult, which is why some of the stories that I tell in the book of semi illiterate people who have left Jamaica and who have come to America and who have made it, which is one of the things that I think makes America the greatest country on earth. People who would never have made it in Jamaica and have come to America and with limited skills have managed to maneuver and navigate the system and have made something substantial of their lives.
You use this term pigmentocracy. I've never heard that before. It's a wonderful term. It's a horrible idea, but it's a wonderful term. And then you also mentioned the one drop rule for our listeners who might not be familiar with it. It's this notion that in the history of the United States, if you have one drop of black blood, you're considered black. And I phrase it that way because you come to America as a Jamaican. And in the sort of American taxonomy, the large scale American taxonomy, you become classified as black. But it's much more complicated than that. There's at minimum, there's Caribbean blacks, there's Native American born blacks, there's African blacks. To what extent did you feel, I don't know, pressure to identify with the larger group? And to what extent did it make you feel like you were misrepresenting yourself, if it did at all?
Well, I had no illusions about what I was going to be identified as. I grew up for the first 21 years in Jamaica as not having a race. I mean, I came from a very mixed race and mixed ethnic background. My grandmother's father was a Sephardic Jew, and her mother was she was mixed with East Indian and black. On my father's side, there was European ancestry. One parent was white and the other was black. And my grandfather, my mother's father, was Hispanic, and so I came from a very mixed background, and was identified as a brown skinned person. I never knew I was black until I came to America, and was identified as such because I was always identified as a brown person. But I knew very, very clearly because I had read American history very clearly. So I knew upon arrival in America, and especially coming to Atlanta in 1985, that such would be the identity that I would inherit. And I had no misgivings or no, I thought, you know, I'm a realist. I'm a romantic, but I'm also a romantic realist. So I thought, this is the country that I'm coming to. And for me, adopting a black identity was more of a political identity than it was a racial identity. It was an identity that in my future work I could use as a position of advocacy, and not a cultural identity, or not certainly not a biological identity. So I didn't feel pressured, and I didn't feel any sense of resentment. I thought America, unfortunately, has, and it's one of the defects of America, that it has a one-drop rule which forces people to discredit the multiplicity of heritages and ethnic backgrounds to which they belong by overdetermining their identities and forcing them into just embracing one aspect of their heritage. I think this is going to change in the future. I think this is not going to be the case as our society becomes more cosmopolitan. But personally, I did not feel like I was pressured, or I didn't feel any sort of resentment about it.
Was this lack of feeling of pressure, was that a choice? I mean, I think about the 1980s. You came in 1985. I think about this is the rise of Spike Lee. We're seeing the end of the 1970s successes with diversity on television and in the movies, and things are becoming much more segregated in a certain sense, for lack of a term. Cornel West is starting, I think Cornel West is starting to make a name for himself at this point. And is there pressure to be associated as a member of this group that you are just choosing to dismiss, or do you not feel the pressure at all?
I don't feel the pressure at all. I have an identity first and foremost as an individual who happens to be Caribbean and who happens to get classified as black in America. My identity, first of all, has always been a moral identity, and that is I seek to identify myself by the actions that I commit and that I wield in the world, my convictions, my values. And personally, in my deepest self-image is always reinforced by those values, those convictions, and those actions, and not by a skin tone or a skin color or a racial ascriptive identity, which has nothing to do with the content of my character and has nothing to do with who I am as a person. It has always been very, very seriously for me to have a deep racial identity, because that has nothing to do with me as a person, whereas my values and my consciously held convictions and the actions that I execute in the world every day say something substantially about who I am. So that racial identity has always been peripheral to who I have taken myself to be. And that, again, is what it means to be a rugged, intransigent, inviolable individualist.
You used two different phrases. First, you used political identity when you were talking about taking the role of advocate. And then you used moral identity in terms of your character. Now, these are concepts that political philosophers have been struggling with, and since the 60s and early 70s with John Rawls, there's this idea of individualism requiring what sometimes is called a thin theory of the self, which is that the identity that's foisted upon us is thin, it's not robust, it doesn't have all of these other attachments that what we are individuals who can choose. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about what it means to have a political identity. You mentioned briefly what it means to have a moral identity. How do those differ, and how do those help you think about what it means to be an individual?
Well, for me, the political part of having this political identity that I talk about is part of what it means to be an American citizen, right? That is, whether you're a Republican, whether you're an independent, a libertarian, or a Democrat, it means in some sense holding a thin adherence and allegiance to the core values of the Republic that unite us all as Americans. I respect the freedom of conscience of all my fellow Americans. I respect their First Amendment, their Second Amendment rights, their freedom to hold their values, their freedom to carve out a conception of the good life for themselves. Even if I find the conception of the good life that they have carved out for themselves offensive to my sensibilities, I will fight to the death for their freedom to carve out that conception of the good life, so long as it's not violating the rights of other people. If someone wants to form a conception of the good life around worshiping a Christmas tree on Mount Rushmore, God bless him. It's not the way that I would choose to organize my life, but he is or she is free to do so. So when I talk about having a political identity, it's not just the identity that I hold around whatever political party I might belong to. It's the set of American ideals that unite us in civic unity and trust that is transcendent. Those are transcendent ideals, American ideals, that I can say to Democrats or Republicans or Libertarians, my politics, or anarchists even, although those people are very difficult to deal with, but I can say...
By definition,
I can say I hold a set of core values that unite our republic together that make it possible for all of us to have a common conversation and a common way of living together without clashing into ethnic or religious problems or violence, I should say, turmoil, that we can have reasonable people can have reasonable disagreements. That is only possible when you have a civilized society that agrees to adhere to a thin set of political values around which the Republic is organized. And I think that's part of what the Republic of France is doing when it matriculates its citizens through the lycée and says, you know, you can have a conception of the good life, but you must be able to speak the French language. And there are certain values that are inimical to the French Republic, and I think the same thing in America. Gender equality is one of them, freedom of speech, freedom of association, freedom of assembly, freedom of conscience. That's what I'm sort of talking about when I talk about those political values.
I talk about France a lot with my students when I'm talking about the idea of diversity, and I talk about the lycée, the schools, and I explain that in America, diversity means anyone can wear whatever headdress or other religious paraphernalia they want in a school, because diversity means full religious expression. But in France, religious diversity means nobody wears that, because the Republic comes first and religion is a purely private matter. When we get back after the break, I want to talk about this, and I want to talk about your claim in the book that race is not part of the American metaphysics and what that means, and then bring it into the contemporary conversation about writers like Ta-Nehisi Coates and see what this attitude about individualism has to say about other controversies, Black Lives Matter, et cetera. But first, you're listening to Jason Hill and Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. We'll be back right after this.
The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life bridges the gap between academic philosophy and the general public. Its mission is to cultivate discussion between philosophy professionals and others who have an interest in the subject, regardless of experience or credentials. Visit us on the web at philosophyandpubliclife.org. The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, because there is no ivory tower.
You're back with Jack Russell Weinstein and Jason D. Hill on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. We're talking about immigration. We're talking about race. We're about to start talking about contemporary political debate and the way that individualism offers us a way of navigating these decisions. And it's funny, I was listening to Jason talk and I had a sentence popped into my head, which was, I didn't become a Jew until I left New York City. And what that meant was that when I grew up for the first 17 years of my life in New York, I became bar mitzvah. My father was religious at various different points, but it was not noteworthy. There were other Jews around, just like there were lots of other kinds of people around. When I moved out, first to college, where it wasn't a big deal in upstate New York, but then eventually to Vienna, Austria, California, and then here in Grand Forks, North Dakota, becoming Jewish became much more important to me because it became much more obvious to me that in the face of the diversity, in the face of certain kinds of resistance, I really began to identify what it meant for me to be Jewish. But of course, every day that I express that is a choice, and how important that is, whether my Jewishness is in the foremost notion of my mind, or being a professor is, or being a father is, or being a jogger or what have you. These are choices about what I want to focus on, and it makes me wonder how removable these things are to me. Can I stop being a New Yorker? Can I stop being Jewish? Can I stop being a father, not in the biological sense at least, but in the commitment sense? And I don't have an answer to this question. But what America allows us to do is make those choices because there's no requirement to be one specific thing. At least, Jason, that's what I understand you to be saying when you say that there is no racial metaphysics in the United States. What does that mean?
Well, it means a couple of things. One is that, so let me start by saying that America's obviously had a very ugly racial history, and that, you know, the basic birth defect in the creation of America was chattel slavery. And there's no going around that. The birth of America was problematic from its inception. It was ugly in many respects. But the creation of America and the creation of the American Constitution had at its forefront the inalienability of man's rights. That is, in its political DNA, it recognized the intrinsic dignity of all persons. It just never lived up to it when applying that to women, actually, and to black people. So race in and of itself and the ascription of or lack of ascription of agency to people of color and to women, for the most part, was a betrayal of the American ideal in the first place. And we have had a series of progressive political movements that have sought to correct that, first with the Civil War, which I think was a magnificent war, as brutal, slaughterous as it was a war to end slavery and to restore freedom to blacks. We saw the suffragette movement, which granted women the right to vote, and the women's liberation movement, which granted the feminist movement, and we've seen, you know, we have marital equality where gays have a right to marry and so on and so forth. The second thing about there being no metaphysics of race is that race has ceased continuously to be a determinative factor of one's destiny. That is, in the old European, in the old world, in old Europe, ethnicity and race were defining characteristics which sealed your fate determinatively. When people left the old country and they came to America, they were free, and not just the old country. When the untouchable leaves India, and no one will touch the untouchable, the Dalit, and he or she comes to America, America gives you a free chance to start over from scratch, to build a future. No one cares, basically, where you came from. You could have come from the most humblest of origins. You come from America and you start from scratch. And this business of lineage and tribalism is a very, very interesting phenomenon. America is an unprecedented phenomenon in the sense that it is a country built on civic nationalism, not cultural or racial or ethnic nationalism. It says, we don't care where you come from. And the membership principle, that is to become an American, unlike Germany, unlike so many European countries in the past, is not, the criterion is not predicated on ethnicity or lineage or blood. It is predicated on something else.
If I can interrupt for a second, it's interesting because you talk about this lineage and comparing it to India. I think about all of the presidential candidates who are working incredibly hard to say they did come from poverty. They did come from the other places. And this ability to go from this humble past to this greatness is actually incredibly valued, I guess, the opposite of the Indian culture that you're referring to.
That's right. That's right.
I guess what's coming to mind is that there are people – the writer Ta-Nehisi Coates comes to mind, and you spend some time talking about him, that say, well, that's just not true, that being black defines who you are, it defines your identity, and it certainly defines your limitations. And being African-American in the United States is a trap that people can't get out of. And then in addition to that, when I read your book and I get excited about this notion that race is not a metaphysics of the United States, and I think this is right, this is great, Coates might come back at me, and certainly many liberals would come back to me and say, well, of course, you can say that because you have white privilege, and that you can say that it's successful because for you it is. You don't get to decide this. And so how do you respond to this very, very vociferous cultural critique right now that – you know, all of that's nice in theory, but in practice, it just isn't true.
Because it's a nefarious lie. Because part of what Ta-Nehisi Coates has left out of his book, in the Between the World and Me, is the fact that he claims that the American dream was a dream built on the backs of blacks. It was exploitative. It was intrinsically racist. And that it was built on exploitation, destruction of families. What he's left out is the fact that the American dream was also part of the Black American story. So the Black experience is completely left out of the American dream. We go back to, he leaves out Black wealth, Black entrepreneurship, Black success stories. What about the Black people who, under Jim Crowism, under segregation, made something remarkably successful of their lives? What about Blacks today who, through grit, honor, tenacity, resilience, and hard work, have made something, including in Black immigrants and Black Americans, have made something remarkably successful of their lives. This universal blanket condemnation of the American dream and inextricably tying the American dream to racism and to exploitation of Blacks is, I think, empirically false, because I think, A, the success stories of Black immigrants who come to this country is a direct refutation of that claim, and the success stories of Blacks in this country, both under segregation and post the 1964 Civil Rights Act and post the 1960 Civil Rights era, who have continued to make great strides and have continued to embrace the American dream and make something substantial of their lives. I mean, we live in an era today where I'm a professor. I've been a professor for 23 years, and I've been at DePaul University for 18 years. And I travel all over the country giving talks on my books. And I can tell you, and I sit on admission committees, I can tell you that if you are a Black person today with a minimal GPA, there is no college campus that will not swoop you up and court and dine you. You are a golden asset today if you're a Black, especially if you're a Black man and you want to get into college. You are a prized nugget, right? There are many ways in which being Black today is an asset. In corporations, if you are a graduate and you apply for a job, there are many ways in which, if you're a white male in academia, things are not so good for you. Right, you're better off being Black if you're an academic. I say this as an academic, a Black academic. If you're a white man in education with a PhD in education, chances are, if you're competing with a Black man with that same PhD, he's going to get the job. So I'm just not buying any of this bogus rap that Black people are endless victims, and that they're left outside the pantheon of the human community, and that the American dream is outside of their, you know, outside of their reach.
I have so many thoughts on what you're saying. The first is this notion of success in the face of Jim Crow and other such things. I would recommend to my listeners, I don't know if you read it, I thought it was wonderful, Edward Jones's wonderful book, The Known World, about that one of the core stories in it is about a black family who is wins their freedom or given their freedom. I can't remember. And then themselves own slaves and how complicated that is.
Yes, I know that book. Yes,
it's so beautifully written, and it's just so there's that element, and then there's I want to ask you about the critique that what you say may be true in some sense, but isn't that another form of tokenism or objectifying blacks by giving them pride of place? But before I ask those questions, I just want to point out that you became so animated when I brought up Ta-Nehisi Coates and this, and your criticism is so incredibly heartfelt. This is clearly, and this comes through, of course, in the book, this is clearly not just an academic matter for you. This is really a covenant, a love letter to the country, and it clearly infuriates you when someone comes along and tries to undermine that story that you think is so deeply meaningful and true.
Yes. Well, there are two things here. One is Ta-Nehisi Coates is a hypocrite because he's living the American dream. This man is making millions of dollars. This is the only place where a black man can curse off white liberals and tell them that they're racist, that they're mean-spirited, exploitative people, and they award him with a National Book Award, a MacArthur Genius Foundation Award, and accolades. Nowhere else in the world can a black man tell white people that they're evil, mean-spirited, racist, and they make him a rich person. So he's living the American dream. But the other thing is that, yes, I am deeply in love with America. I'm a great patriot of this republic. I have a visceral love. I love America the way a mother loves a wayward son. Not that I'm saying that America is a wayward country. I think it's the most moral country and the greatest country on the face of the earth. And I spell out in the book in very clear terms why I think America is the greatest country on the face of the earth. I define the moral meaning of America and why I think that it's, for me, it's more than visceral. It's a visceral love the way a father or a mother has for a child. But it's also a love that is rooted in convictions and the values that America stands for. And there are very few things that make me angry as I age. Not that many things make me angry. Criticism of America, it's fine. It's not an infallible nation. But anti-Americanism, which I'm witnessing on college campuses across this great republic, anti-Americanism, invective spewed against this great country, make me very, very angry. And when I see privileged, very ultra-privileged writers such as Ta-Nehisi Coates sitting up there in his luxurious life, spewing invectives and hatred against America, while America continues to bestow accolades and wealth upon him, just infuriates me.
Chris Rock said once that he is living amongst the nicest white people who ever walked the earth, and that speaks to this notion that Coates can offer these horrendous criticisms and be rewarded for it. I'm curious what the difference is in your mind between criticizing America and anti-Americanism. Where's the line?
Well, here's the line. I think, and I think this comes into play as an intellectual, which I am, and as a professor and a writer, it comes at the level of demonizing versus the level of policy. So someone asked me about the president, and I said, look, I'm not a psychologist. I'm not going to get into character analysis of the president. I'm a policy person, and I've been that way when I voted for Obama. And I voted for when I became an American citizen to vote in 2002. And we've spoken about my voting habits.
Yes.
And I voted for John Kerry and so on and so forth. And I said, I'm a policy kind of person. I evaluate policies. I'll be the first person to say, I agree with the president's policy on this level. And I think the president's policy here is abhorrent. I think when it comes to criticism, you can say, look, America, like I was the first to say, America's racial past has been ugly, and it's had a horrible racial past. It is also a self-correcting society with self-correcting mechanisms that is always trying to improve itself. Anti-Americanism is when you paint the country as irredeemably bad, intrinsically bad, when you paint the American people as intrinsically mean-spirited, bigoted, racist, that by constitutional design, Americans are bigoted, mean-spirited, and racist, and xenophobic. That is anti-Americanism. That is empirically false. That is just not true. We have to look at the civil rights movement. We have to look at the role that Jews and so many whites played in the civil rights movement. Why the hell did white people, including Jews, risk their lives going on freedom rides? Why are so many of my white students at DePaul, I can't count how many number of white students are members of the Black Lives Matter movement who are giving their time and effort to racial, the social justice warriors. So the story is just much more complicated than that. American foreign policy has been complicated. It has been hypocritical. It has been disastrous for the past 75 years. I'm writing a book on American foreign policy. That's coming out. It's 400 pages. I have to get it down to at least 200. But American foreign policy has also been extremely altruistic, beneficial. It's helped a lot of third world countries, including the country I come from. It's lifted many nations out of poverty. It's also harmed some countries. It's a complicated picture. And just damning America outright as this evil imperialistic country is sloppy, and it's mean, and it's hurtful. It's hurtful to someone who loves the country and who wanted to be here. And I'll stand up and defend it the way, to use a female archetype, the way a mother bear would defend her cub. I just won't have it.
I think about we are pre-recording, so there was a little radio magic when I wished you a happy birthday. That was a future-oriented happy birthday. But today it came out when we're pre-recording that yesterday Roseanne Barr sent out a very racist tweet comparing an Obama official, a black woman, to an ape. Mm-hmm. And she her show was canceled. And not only that, it came out this morning that – and I don't know by the time this broadcasts if this will still be the case. I suspect it will because it happened with Bill Cosby – that they're taking off all the reruns from all of the Roseanne shows because she tweeted something racist. Now, A, that's how the market works when it works well. But B, that has never happened before in American history, that someone has said something racist and they're being profoundly punished. Do you think that that is a revocation? Do you think that that undermines Coates' argument? Or do you think that that's something else is going on? Is this evidence of not just racial progress, but of this deep commitment to a race-free metaphysics that you're talking about? Or is this just coincidence?
No, I think it undermines Coates' argument. Look, two black men got arrested in for doing absolutely nothing, which was unfortunate
in Starbucks.
Starbucks, yeah. And Starbucks closed down its shops and had a racial bias training, which cost them something in excess of $10 million. Black Lives Matter. I wrote an article in Commentary Magazine a couple of weeks ago that was a cover story on my Black Lives Matter problem, where they march with impunity, without impunity, into Jewish progressive neighborhoods, calling Jewish people genocidal murderers and guilty of apartheid. And you know my position on Israel. I'm radically pro-Israel. I think we're seeing an enormous amount of power on the part of blacks in the public sphere, where they're not being victimized, quite obviously, where their voices do carry weight. But let me say something about the Roseanne tweet. You know, I think there's a double standard here. I think, of course, what she did was despicable, and in a civilized society, we should have no room for that. But Bill Maher, whom I actually like because he makes me laugh,
right,
had a tweet in 2013 in which he put a picture of Trump beside an orangutan and said that Trump's mother must have had sex with an orangutan to produce something like this, right? So I'm all for decency. And as a writer, I never eviscerate people of their dignity. I will criticize their ideas very sharply. And I think when you have to resort to ad hominems and racist remarks, there's a paucity of imagination and a basic lack of decency. So I think what Roseanne did is wrong. But I think also when the left does it, speaking here just impartially, when Joy Reid came out and said, you know, things about gays that were very offensive to gays and made anti-Muslim comments, she went on a cry of the heart apology tour, and she got to keep her job. So I think we've got to be morally consistent here and just demand that we stop these kinds of, on both sides, demonization, and you and I spoke about this in our last broadcast, stop this demonization of both the left and the right and start attacking or criticizing in a cold, dispassionate, rational manner policies. Because I'm not Obama's, I'm not Donald Trump's psychology. Only they and their psychologists are equipped to make psychological statements about their mental health. I can properly criticize as an ethicist, as a political theorist, and as someone who's had extensive training also in psychology, I think, policies of the president or of political actors.
I want to push you on this, though, because on the one hand, there's nothing that you would say that I take issue with at all. Yeah. On the other hand, isn't there a fundamental difference between comparing an African-American woman, saying that she's the child of an ape, using a racist trope and a standard way of demeaning someone that has really nothing to do with them but much more to do with the racist history of the United States? Isn't there a difference between that and let's say – I didn't see Whoopi Goldberg's shirt, but Whoopi Goldberg's shirt, which is a – political hyperbole that is about the individual person and the individual person's policy, which is his policy on guns, presumably. It's not nice. I don't recommend it. I'm not suggesting – I'm not defending the T-shirt. But isn't equating the two missing the point that if there is no racial metaphysics in the United States, that racist comments are on a whole different level than other forms of political protest because they're so much worse?
Well, I think that's right. And I didn't mean the analogy to be a sort of perfect one. I sort of meant more of the like the Donald Trump mother must have had sex with an orangutan, right, to be more of a closely related analogy. But you know, it really just gets back to the whole issue of offensiveness and what people find. The country is deeply divided right now, and what people find offensive. And the point here is that I, as a writer, and I, as someone who makes a living partially, my living comes from being a professor, but partially makes a living from writing, find it very, very disturbing when we get into the realm of its sloppiness and it's intellectually lazy of resorting to offensive symbolisms of just personally attacking people as opposed to attacking their ideas. And I think we've got to get back to something like what John McCain, I've been reading a lot of what he's been writing and what in his memoir and advocating, which is more attacking or critiquing policies and strategies that leaders and political actors pursue, and staying away from the demonization of the individuals themselves. It's just counterproductive. It's mean-spirited. And actually, it gets us nowhere.
I want to in a minute, I want to ask you to tell a story that you tell in the book about an immigrant you knew who started a grass-cutting business, because I think it offers a good contrast, not just the upward mobility, but also the work stability and habits in his home country. But before that, I want to ask – in my head, it's sort of the opposite. Not the mean-spiritedness, but the glorification of cultures. I don't know if you've seen – I don't know if you're a movie fan. I don't know if you've seen Black Panther, but I'm curious.
I have.
How do you feel, not necessarily about the movie itself, right? I thought it was very good. I've seen it several times. But about the cultural power and impact and the way in which it was received, both marketed and received as this glorification of Black collectivity. Does something like Black Panther run afoul of your individualism and your resistance to this, the primacy of group identity, or is something else going on there?
No, I thought it was a remarkable movie. I thought it runs afoul no more than Batman or Spider-Man or Superman, okay, all of which are populated by white characters and white superheroes. I thought it was a remarkable movie. Well, it was an okay movie just on the level of an action-packed,
thrill ride.
Right. The plot was formulaic, and you could tell what was going to happen, which made it no different than any sort of superhero movie. Which is fine; they all have to follow a formulaic theorem. But what I thought was amazing was that it wasn't a story about victimology. It wasn't a story about blaming the white man for the Black man's problem. Quite the opposite. It was a story in which Black people were doing the impossible. And that's what made it a form of romanticism. Black people were doing the impossible and overcoming obstacles. It was a film in which whites were actually irrelevant and incidental to Black people's lives, and a story in which actually Blacks could be benevolent towards the white characters who were in there and offer a spirit of generosity. So I think more movies like this should be made. It wasn't glorifying. It wasn't some sort of homage to Black collectivity. I just think it happened to be a movie in which there were Black characters, predominantly Black characters, and which made it no different than any other mainstream Hollywood movie in which there are predominantly white characters. But it was celebrating something much more beautifully, which was the dignity of Black people in a movie that celebrated heroism. There was a morality tale to it. There were principled moral. It was a medieval, like a medieval morality tale where you had good fighting evil, and it wasn't afraid to pit a Black man as an evil character against another Black man who was the heroic moral character. So it didn't run afoul of my individualism at all. I think quite the opposite. It portrayed Blacks in a wonderful and beautiful, elegant and dignified manner. The costumes, the acting, everything about that movie, I think, on an aesthetic, cinematic, and even philosophical manner was quite well done.
What strikes me is that one of the key conflicts in the movie is about this debate as to whether or not the Wakandans, the nation portrayed, have a responsibility to help other Black people to go into other countries, whether it's revolutionary or technologically or what have you. And this evokes to me your criticism of Black Lives Matter, that its focus is on the wrong thing, right? Talk a little bit about what you think Black Lives Matter is doing wrong by focusing exclusively on the police?
Well, there are two things. One is let me just say that I was a fan of Black Lives Matter when the movement first started, because I thought it had legitimate concerns. It was addressing the concerns of the shooting of unarmed Black men in this country, which was tragic, which needed to be addressed. It has, however, strayed from its lane. When you look at its manifesto, it is calling for the breakup of U.S. banks. It is calling for the destruction of the U.S. economy in many ways. It's calling for the free education of all Blacks. I don't know why free education of all Blacks, but not poor whites or Native Americans. And it's attacking Israel and calling Israel a genocidal apartheid state, alienating progressive Jews from the Black Lives Matter movement. What I think the Black Lives Matter movement should be doing is turning its signs from white people, moving into the black community where black-on-black crime is so astronomically high, into like the south side of Chicago where black people are killing other black people, working with gang members and holding gang members accountable and saying, what are you doing? What are you people doing? What is it with the drive-by shootings? What is it with the disproportionate homicidal rates in the black community being committed predominantly by these gang members? They have some kind of credibility here where they could be working with these gang members. They could be working strategically with police officers to try to build trust, because there is an absence of trust between the police officers, between police, between law enforcement in general, and these African and Hispanic communities. Black Lives Matter should be strategically working with police officers, white, black, and Hispanic, and trying to reintegrate them back into these communities instead of spewing, right? Instead of spewing these invectives against law enforcement in general, discrediting the reputation of law enforcement. They should be working closely to try to reestablish trust between law enforcement and neighborhoods. And more importantly, holding the black community and the career criminality element within these communities accountable to some higher standard. It's not doing that. It's turning its signs and listening to people like Ta-Nehisi Coates who has said that talking about black-on-black crime is like shooting a man and blaming him for bleeding, which is utter nonsense.
You have a statistic, I hope I get it right, in the book that I found tremendously interesting. I think you said 93% of homicides are intraracial, meaning that roughly 93% of homicides in the black community are caused by other blacks. In the white community, whatever those terms community means, are white. I may have the number wrong, but certainly if this is the case, then this notion of almost a race war that some people talk about, the right will call it a race war, the left will call it oppression, that's largely inaccurate and the wrong narrative. And so what you're suggesting, if I understand correctly, is that what Black Lives Matter has to do is do what Malcolm X suggested, which is stay within the community where they have the influence and the power and try to bring the community up, whatever that means, from within.
That's right. They can be a moral voice. They have a great opportunity where they have some credibility and they can be a moral voice in the black community and not give up trying to win. Look, there are a lot of well-intentioned and well-meaning white people who are members of Black Lives Matter. I think of Martin Luther King. This could be a great opportunity to follow King's example, where King, notice that Martin Luther King never demonized white people, right? He had every opportunity in his time to call white people venomous and evil and mean-spirited. And what did he do? He preached a doctrine of love, and he won more whites over to his side because he preached a moral vision of unity and love. And Black Lives Matter is living or operating in a much more progressive time than Martin Luther King, where it has voluntarily attracted much more progressive whites into its fold. And so I don't think it necessarily should exclude whites from the movement, but it can do work on multiple levels. And I think the majority of its work should be done within the black community.
I think the worst thing that I can think of that Martin Luther King said about white people is reserved for white liberals in the letter from Birmingham Jail, where he complains that they're too passive, that they speak these things but that they don't act, and that they're worried about rocking the boat. Yeah. Do you think that – I'm trying to figure out how to ask this question. Do you think that your experience as an immigrant allows you to see things about – Black Lives Matter that a native-born African-American wouldn't see? Is this – how much of your criticism comes from the juxtaposition of being Caribbean-born and in this sort of sector of the Black community as opposed to being native-born. How much of this is I'm not sure how to ask this question. How much there is a literature on tensions in America between Caribbean Blacks, African Blacks, and native-born African Americans. How much of this is that conflict being manifest, and how much of this is just this is you as an individual, this is your choice. You see it. We can all see it if we're educated properly. I'm trying to bring the issue of immigration back on the table, and I'm just curious how much of your criticism of what's happening in the United States with race is available to you because you came from the outside and because you have an experience of immersing yourself in as opposed to always having been in here.
Right. That's a very interesting question, and I think it requires a very nuanced and subtle answer, not a knee-jerk sort of answer.
All right. Well, then we're done here.
So, you know, in all fairness, I have to say that I never sat in the back of a bus. I never grew up in an inner city. And knock on wood and fingers crossed, I've never been harassed by a white police officer. I live in Lincoln Park and, you know, police officers see me every day. They wave to me. I ride my bike in the park at 1 o'clock in the morning and white police officers will say to me, just be careful. I've lived there for 18 years. So I think had I had a different experience, I might have had a different perspective. That's the first thing to say. Having said that, I don't think your race necessarily determines your perspective, because I have met other Black Americans who are who are conservative and who are also left of center liberals, who are actually frustrated with Black Lives Matter. I have met kids from the inner city who don't necessarily voice it as an explicit frustration with Black Lives Matter, but who are desperate for some kind of leadership, some kind of voice, who cannot make it to school at DePaul, who are on scholarship because they have to cross gang turf and whose only choice is to either join a gang or be killed or be beaten up. And so they drop out of school because they can't make it from the South Side over to Lincoln Park. And they are frustrated. They are in dire need of some kind of leadership, some kind of voice. And I think out of fear of being called a sellout or or something less charitable than that, they give some sort of allegiance to Black Lives Matter. But I think if you sat many of them down on a one-on-one basis and promised them confidentiality, they would say, we want some kind of advocacy. We need a voice. Rahm Emanuel is not doing it, right? No one is doing it for them. They're left without any kind of voice. I just wrote a letter that was widely published last week and that I've been doing the rounds in the media, asking President Trump to send federal troops in, the National Guard.
There's at least one video on YouTube of you being interviewed about this, so I encourage people to take a look if they're interested. Sorry, go on.
Yeah, to send troops in to quell the gang warfare that's going on in Chicago. Because it's just getting out of control. Because if this were happening on the Gold Coast and white people were being shot to death en masse, it wouldn't be tolerated, right? But I thought when my students are telling me, my Black students are telling me that they can't come to school as they have in the past because of gang warfare, I thought if you care about human lives, not just all lives matter, if you care about human lives, then something has to be done. And the police force is undermanned and underpersoned. So I don't think it's necessarily because I think partially it's because I was spared that experience that I can be so forthright. But I think there are an equal number of individuals in the Black community who feel that frustration and would want Black Lives Matter to be speaking as advocates for them.
So then, again, before we move on to the next topic, the voice in my head of Coates, of the Cornel Wests, of other folks would say, but you yourself just said that if it were white people who were being killed, they wouldn't stand for it. Is this not evidence that Coates and others are correct, that there is institutional structures that predetermine the failure and success of African Americans?
Well, look, I think it's an issue of affluence. I think if you go into any society, if you went to Jamaica and the rich brown people were being shot up to death, it wouldn't be tolerated. I think if you went into we saw the same thing in America, where in Columbine, where it was predominantly working class students who were being killed, it was silence. And recently with the gun shootings, where it was middle class students who were being killed, they made their way onto the cover of Time magazine. I think it's more an issue of when the affluent and the middle class and the upper middle class are affected, then attention is being paid or starts being paid to those who are being affected. So I'm not so naive to think that we live in a country where people really, really think that all lives matter equally. That's what we should be aspiring to. But I do think that, and I think this is correct, that if the affluent are being gunned down and killed disproportionately, that greater attention would be paid to that sort of the egregious violation of rights would be attended to in a far quicker manner. But I think it's more I think it's more complicated than just a racial issue here.
I'm thinking of the neglect of rural poor America when it comes to the opioid crisis and meth here in North Dakota that's decimating communities, in Appalachia that's decimating communities, where it is class
That's right.
and economic status and not race. I want to shift to this back to the conversation of immigration and the American dream, and I wonder if you'd tell the story that you tell in the book of the man who started started by mowing your lawn with a lousy lawnmower, and what he said to you when you asked him how he was treated.
Right. So this is a Jamaican who came to this country when my mom and grandmother and myself came. And, you know, he was semi-literate. He could barely speak, like a lot of Jamaicans, poor Jamaicans who don't speak English. He could barely speak standard English. He spoke the local dialect, Patois, but was watching some TV and was acquiring the English language. And so he started mowing my mother's lawn with a rickety lawnmower. And then obviously the neighbors liked what he was doing, so they asked him to mow their lawn. And he was mowing another lawn. Then he acquired a new lawnmower. And to cut a very long story short, he was doing half the subdivision with a tractor mower. And then in a year's time, he had acquired two tractor mowers and had six Mexicans working under him and was doing the entire subdivision. And I asked him, I said to him, it was a predominantly white because we were living, it was mostly, there were a lot of, when we first moved to Atlanta, we lived in Klan country, Ku Klux Klan country, because land was cheap. And as fearless Caribbeans, we were not afraid of the Ku Klux Klan. We wanted cheap land, and we weren't about to change anybody's lifestyles. We just wanted land that was cheap. So it was a predominantly white community. And I said, how are the white people treating you? And he said, they treat me quite good. He said, they treat me good. And I said, you mean they treat you well? And because I was trying to teach him standard English. And and he said, no, they treat me good. And he said, they actually gave me water in a tall glass. But the important thing was that they paid him on time. And he couldn't get over how well they were paying him. They respected him as a trader. And this was a mark of courtesy and respect, where they didn't make social intrusions into his life and try to sort of worm their way into his life in an intimate, friendly way, but just respected boundaries and went over and beyond by treating him with a kind of dignity and respect that he didn't, that was obvious, that it was obvious to him that had somehow surpassed the way that he would have been treated had he been back in Jamaica, where he would have been really treated as a second-class citizen. I don't think, he would have been accorded that sort of respect.
You report that he said that, you know, sometimes they even pay in advance, which no one ever does in Jamaica. And your book has a lot of memoir aspects. It ends with some personal struggles of yours that are very moving. But I have to say that I think the moment of the book that got to me in the emotional sense the most was the moment when you say, when you report him saying that they often give me a glass of water in a real glass with pride and respect. And you then go on to talk about how in America, when you show up someplace with an accent, people are curious where you're from, that they don't, they're not resistant. And you do a very good and moving job of talking about how this immigration status, regardless of the politics right now, is really valued and a curiosity of people. Do you think that this is the legacy of this race-free metaphysics, that this curiosity about accents and where people come from? And I wonder if you'd also talk a little bit about how the forwardness of the American vision as opposed to the historical focus and how that connects to this curiosity.
Well, yes. I mean, I have lived in the deep – I've lived in five states in America. I lived in the deep south and in Georgia, and I've lived in St. Louis, upstate New York, Indiana, where I did my doctorate, my PhD, Illinois, and I think there's one other state that's missing. And I have found that I still have an accent, and I have found that accent has elicited more curiosity than it has hostility, especially in the South, where people would say, would say, back then, of course, I allowed them to call me a boy because I was 20 or 21 and looked like 15. So they would say, boy, where are you from? And and I would always tell them where I was from. And you know, I've traveled around the world. I've had the advantage of traveling around the world, fortunately, with the kind of work that I do. And I have seen where foreign accents elicit hostility. And I think it's just remarkable that in America, now we're living in an age where if you ask people where they're from, it's considered insulting. And I think that's just horrible, because I think people like when Americans say, where are you from? Because it shows both curiosity and people like, where people come from is very important to them. Their roots are still very important to them. And to have an American acknowledge your roots and your origins is a show of respect. And I'm very hopeful for the future. I think that, you know, we're in a transitional period in terms of, for example, our refugee policy and our immigration policies. But I still think that fundamentally this is a non-xenophobic country. That is, I have lived here for 32 years, and as I said, I've lived in different states, and I've taught black kids in East St. Louis. I've taught Klan members. I don't know if I told you the story of living, of teaching in Edwardsville, where 85% of my students identified as Klan members.
You did not, and it's not in the book.
No, it's not in the book. They were from Vandalia, and they used to call it Klandalia. And they saw me at a gas station and told me, don't go to that gas station because it's populated by Klan members. But so I've taught a broad, and now I teach very privileged, progressive students at DePaul, And I've taught in Ivy League schools. I've taught at Cornell and Columbia University in New York. And I've been at DePaul now for 18 years as a tenured professor. So I've seen a lot of America, and I give talks all over this country. And, you know, I don't think you've lived in America, and you can agree with me coming from Dakota, living in Dakota. But unless you've lived in the heartland, you don't, you know, you live in New York City and you live in this little bubble. And you live on the East Coast, the West Coast, and you live in this bubble. But unless you've really lived in the heartland and you've traveled Kansas, the Dakotas, Illinois, Ohio, Wisconsin, Iowa, you really haven't seen America. And I think I have really seen America and engaged with the American people. And I think that going back to something we talked about the last time, if you do not have a sense of entitlement, if you work hard and pull yourself up and are self-reliant, Americans actually respect that. You know, as I said, when I came to this country and I worked 45 hours a week and put myself through school before winning a scholarship to do a PhD, I have found that most Americans respect that. What they don't want is a sense of entitlement, like we owe you something. Because immigration is not a right, it's a privilege.
And this is connected. This is connected to your observation, and I think these are my words, not yours, but that America is forward, not backward looking. That it's not where you come from, but it's where you're going that's the most relevant to America.
That's right. That's right. It's not a very nostalgic place, and it's actually not a very sentimental country. And you're basically as good as your present performance, or it's a salesman's country, as much as you can convince the next person how well you're likely to perform in the future, which I love about this country because it gives you a chance to fail and then to recoup from your failure and to convince your compatriot that I can actually make something substantial of my life by future possibilities that lay ahead of me. And that's when people talk about America, I throw statistics at you and talk about, you know, equality of outcome versus equality of opportunities. I say the possibilities themselves are what make America remarkable, because there are countries in this world, there are states in this world that don't even grant you the opportunities. The opportunities themselves are what make America a golden place. Because I've seen the other side, where the paucity of opportunities, the absence of opportunities, the dearth of opportunities strangles people's lives, you know, make it almost impossible for them to make a step forward. And the fact that we live in a country with so many opportunities, so many possibilities, that for people to stand here now and say, well, because the outcomes are not as we think they should be, is just ludicrous. Short of a utopianistic state, America cannot promise you success. It can only give you the opportunity and say, work as hard as you can. But short of a bloated totalitarian planned state, no free country can provide you with that sort of guaranteed success.
And that's going to lead to my last question, although I will remark, and I may have said this on the show once before, that quite a few years ago I heard on the radio panel discussion, and there was, I think, an ambassador from Pakistan who said that America is the only country where the phrase, well, that's history, means it's irrelevant. that everywhere else, history, the weight of history makes all these decisions, and in America, it's, that's in the past. It doesn't count. And I think that really is a way of summarizing your very point, which is this lack of sentimentality, this lack of this, it's about what you're trying to do and how hard you work. And so then I ask you, as an immigrant, and this is a sort of ridiculous question, but you'll know what I mean by it, how free are we in America? Because there are a lot of people who think we aren't free. There are a lot of people who think we were less free than we were. And this is true on the left and the right. They're just different justifications for it. There is a discourse now that American freedom is a myth, it's a caricature, that we aren't. And so from the perspective of the immigrant, from the perspective of the person who wrote the book that we're talking about, again, whose pre-sale is available on Amazon, how free are we in America?
Well, comparatively speaking, in abstraction, it's difficult to answer that question. But comparatively speaking, those who think that we aren't free, I would say pack your bags and go to Saudi Arabia, go to Iran, go to North Korea, and just find out how free you really are.
How about Italy? How about Greece? How about Brazil? Those are the extreme countries that I think most everyone would agree. What about the more democratic, more capitalist economic powerhouses?
I still think there's a reason why people from those countries are coming to America in far greater numbers than are Americans emigrating to those countries. There's still something fundamentally magical and wondrous about this great republic of ours that is an attractant to people from Brazil, from Sweden, the beloved Sweden, that is supposed to be this, you know, golden place of the and Finland producing. And I love those countries. I spent a lot of time there. They're wonderful countries, but they're supposed to be producing the happiest people in the world. But far more people from Sweden are emigrating, and Finland, and Brazil.
And Finns are not happy. I've spent a lot of time in Finland. They are not happy people.
Far more of them are coming here than Americans are emigrating there. There's something about this country, and it's not just about making money. It's about the possibility of remaking your life into something new. There's something about having a vision of your life, of an aspirational identity, what I want to become in my life, what I want my life to be. And America grants you that chance to rewrite the script. America grants you the chance to rewrite, to revisit the narratives that were bequeathed to you and say, I want to be something different. I want to engage in this process of becoming a new type of human being. It's more than just money. It's the chance to achieve a new type of humanity in your own person. And I don't think that that kind of possibility is to be had in most other countries. And I think that is the magic, that's part of the magic of America. It is a radical kind of freedom. It's a scary kind of freedom because America just sets you loose. And because it doesn't guarantee you that outcome, you see, this is the thing. It says, okay, you want it? Go ahead. There are all these opportunities. You can go to Silicon Valley. You can go here. You can go there. But we can't guarantee you the outcome. But I remember at 20 years old, having all these possibilities ahead of me and feeling like a giddy kid in a candy shop thinking, and I remember getting into 25 law schools, and I never studied for the LSAT. I just took it on a whim and got into 25 law schools. And then I got into these PhD schools to do my PhD in philosophy. And then I thought, oh, I could do an MBA also, and I could do all these things. And then I also wanted to go to Hollywood, and I was writing these screenplays, and I was going to make my way across Hollywood. And then I wrote a novel, and I thought I could become a novelist. And I thought, this is America. And then I thought, you know, I really want to be a philosopher, and I want to be a professor.
Ah, you fool.
You know, but this is the magic of America, and this is why people come here. So for the detractors, I say pack your bags. You know, do not get inoculated. Do not get any kind of inoculation against any kind of diseases. Go trek in the Amazon. Try and experiment somewhere else. Try living somewhere else. See how free you are. See what life is like there without the protections and the opportunities of America. And then come back to Dr. Hill and write to him and tell him what you think about this land of freedom that you relinquished. Then we can talk.
The book is called We Have Overcome, An Immigrant's Letter to the American People. It's available right now in pre-sale on Amazon. We will have a link on our webpage, and then when it's available for regular sale, that link will still be good. Jason, I am sure that when your next book comes out, we will have you on again. You are always a tremendous interview, and I will say it'll be July 4th in a few weeks. It is nice to have an optimistic, enthusiastic, empowering message on the show to remind us of of what we have as opposed to what we don't have. So thank you so much for your second, and I hope the second of many visits to Y Radio.
Thank you, Jack. Thank you so much.
You have been listening to Jason D. Hill and Jack Russell Weinstein on Y Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'll be back with a few thoughts right after this.
Visit IPPL's blog, PQED, Philosophical Questions Every Day, for more philosophical discussions of everyday life. Comment on the entries and share your points of view with an ever-growing community of professional and amateur philosophers. You can access the blog and view more information on our schedule, our broadcasts, and the Y Radio store at www.philosophyandpubliclife.org.
You're back with Jack Russell Weinstein here on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. We were talking with Jason Hill about immigration, the promise of America, and all sorts of racial politics that were challenging and interesting. He said something towards the very end, just a line in passing. He said, it's a salesman's country. And he was talking about the fact that you are valued by what you're trying to do and what you can convince other people that you've done is valuable. And it's no accident that Arthur Miller's A Death of a Salesman is one of the great American plays because it shows what happens when things go right and when things go wrong. And it shows the relationship between the appearance of working hard and actually working hard and the American dream. The American dream, that's a romantic phrase. It's laden with positive and negative emotions. For people who've achieved the American dream, it's one of the greatest things there is. And for people who are striving or feel excluded, it's much more complicated. But the question isn't whether any individual has made it. The question is whether any individual can make it. And that's the controversy that we've put forth today. How free are all Americans, whether they are foreign-born or born in the United States, how free are they to achieve? From Jason's perspective, everyone is free to achieve. Individuals make the choices and the decisions that allow them to push ahead of the racism that exists, the interference that exists, the difficulties that exist. But there is so much more opportunity, he thinks, in the United States. There's so much more potential and freedom and welcomeness in the United States than any other place because it's not about your tribe. It's not about your history. It's not about your race, he argues. It's about what you can do. It's about the freedom. It's a scary freedom, he reminds us, a radical freedom. Because, as we know from our conversations on the show about existentialism, with freedom comes responsibility. If it's your choice to succeed, then the failure is your responsibility too. Obviously, Jason is not naive. He doesn't think anyone can do anything no matter what. Life is harder for some people than it is for others. And he acknowledges that race and economic class play an important part in the equation. But ultimately, he wants us to understand that as an immigrant, as someone who came from Jamaica to the United States when he was 20 and is living a life that he wants to lead, that this option is open to everybody. The American dream is still very much there. We still are the shining light on the hill. We just have to choose to make the best decisions we can be, to be of good moral character, in his words, and political character, to have a good moral identity and a political identity. And what America does best is allow us to choose our own good, choose our own end. And that's true of immigrants, and it's true of native-born, and it's true, I suspect, of visitors as well. The convert is always the most enthusiastic about his or her religion, and the immigrant is often the most enthusiastic about their new country. Jason is a wonderful model of what America can mean. It's going to be July 4th soon. I hope that we can all take his message and remind ourselves of the promise that we have and the goodness and not necessarily focus on the negatives, which we do too often and too much. You've been listening to Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. It's been a wonderful discussion, and as always, it's an honor to be with you.
Why is funded by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, Prairie Public Broadcasting, and the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences and Division of Research and Economic Development. Skip Wood is our studio engineer. The music is written and performed by Mark Weinstein and can be found on his album Lua y Sol. For more of his music, visit jazzfluteweinstein.com or myspace.com/Mark Weinstein. Philosophy is everywhere you make it, and we hope we've inspired you with our discussion today. Remember, as we say at the Institute, there is no ivory tower.